It's the early 1800s on the Red River Settlement in Tennessee. A whole town is taunted by an entity they can hear, but they can't see. No one's secrets are safe. But for one family in particular, taunting turns to torment. The two biggest targets are John Bell, the head of the family, and his youngest daughter, Betsy. The child suffers brutal physical attacks. John is threatened with death verbally for years until he ultimately succumbs to a mysterious illness with curious symptoms. Or was he poisoned? Either way, his cause of death is officially on record as being attributed to a paranormal force. This is the story of the Bell Witch.
Paranormal with hosts John Sharena and Kelly Gilbert, produced by Dan Gilman. You can listen to our show on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and our website at echopodmedia.com. Also visit us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Please leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Do you have a story that you'd like to share? If so, you can email me at DannyEcho@EchoPodMedia.com. This is Echo Pod Media.
Listening to Dead Tribe Paranormal. I'm Kelly.
And I'm John.
We're interviewing Pat Fitzhugh, who is a researcher, lecturer, and author of ghost stories, southern legends, southern literature even. His books include The Bell Witch Haunting, The Bell Witch, The Full Account, Ghostly Cries from Dixie. He's appeared in radio, TV, movies, magazines, all kinds of things. And we are talking to him today.
Mostly. Basically, we're interviewing a legend.
Yeah. Needs to write a book about himself. So we're going to be talking to him mostly about the Bell Witch legend and the books about it, the A&E series that was released back in October and all that. So how you doing, Pat?
Oh, I am doing great. How are you doing tonight?
We are great.
Very well, thank you.
Happy to be up and running again and
ready to go.
So how about let's just start. Why don't you tell us about yourself and how you're interested in the paranormal even began?
Okay, well, that'll be the easy part. There's not a whole lot to say. I'm just, you know, like the bio says, I'm just an old boy from Tennessee who does a lot of paranormal investigation and research, and written a few books, and I have several more in progress.
Okay.
Very nice.
Was there something that happened with you that made you interested in paranormal all of a sudden, or what?
Well, I've been interested since I was a little kid. My mother would read me ghost stories sometimes, and that would just really intrigue me. And that's where I first heard about the Bell Witch and some others. And, you know, at first, I was a little more afraid than intrigued. But then over time, I found myself, you know, asking more questions and not necessarily being afraid, but, you know, asking more questions and wanting to, you know, delve into these stories and get the truth.
And then so the Bell Witch was one of the first ones that really kind of struck a chord with you?
Yeah, that was one of the first ones, and it happened in the same area where my mother grew up. So she knew all about it, and then when she told me that she knew people who were descendants of the people involved in the legend, you know, I thought, wow, this thing actually had real people, you know. We're not talking Jack and the Beanstalk here, but we're talking, you know, actual people and all these really crazy things that happened to them. So that's the first one I became very interested in.
So you had an in on all of this before you even got started.
Yeah, I had a good source of information because, you know, my mother being a local in that area, I mean, she had read all the books that had been written to date, but she had also heard all the local stories. And, you know, local legends vary a whole lot from the book legends because, you know, just about everybody there that talks about the legend, at least, has a friend or relative who's had something happen to them personally, you know, some kind of experience. So there was just, my mother was just a whole wealth of information about all that.
That's awesome. Like, instead of fake ghost stories, you just had real ghost stories.
Now, was it different stories from different people? I mean, you know how after a while stories vary as they get older and older. Were you hearing different things from different people, or did your mom kind of start you off with what she knew?
Well, she started me off with what she knew, and, you know, some of it was, you know, the things that weren't already in books were things she had already, you know, heard, you know, from other locals. And then, you know, as I got older and started delving into the story myself, I heard some of those same things again, plus even, you know, even more things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's one of the key things about that story. The closer you go to the area where it all happened, the more of these different, you know, stories you hear about it.
So was your interest in this what made you want to become a writer, or did you just happen to want to be a writer anyway and then, oh, perfect, I have a good topic already?
Well, I never really had any intentions of becoming a writer. It just kind of came up due to some projects I had in high school and college that were not paranormal, but where I had to write. And I found myself writing pretty much all the time, even though I didn't really care for it because it was so time-consuming. You know, after a while, you know, learning about the Bell Witch, trying to keep all that information together and then sharing a lot of it that other people didn't have already. And, you know, the same was other ghost stories and paranormal cases. Then I got, you know, into the book side of the writing.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So one of the main reasons that people are so fascinated by the Bell Witch is because, I mean, it is such a popular legend. I mean, everybody, at least in the paranormal, has at least heard of it. There's been movies based on it, based on some of the stories on it. You know, and there's so many different theories as to what the Bell Witch was, who the Bell Witch was, you know, is it a who or an it? So do you want to start off telling us just the story of the legend of the Bell Witch, what it is, and then we can kind of go through the theories one by one?
Yeah, I could tell you a little bit about the legend.
Sit back, people. It's a long story, a good one.
Yeah, it's definitely a long story, and what I'll probably do is give the short version. I know one time I did a lecture at this place. They wanted me to tell the whole story in full, every little bit that I could, you know, that I could tell. And I think this thing went for like almost 6 hours.
Oh my God!
So, and this was just the story. This didn't, you know, no theories, no Q&A, anything like that. Just, you know, strictly the story. This began back in the early 1800s. You know, the John Bell family, they were originally from North Carolina, and they moved to Tennessee around 1805. And what happened after they moved was pretty much nothing. You know, they settled in like some other settler families did. They became members of the church. John Bell became an elder of the church. They farmed their land and eventually acquired more land. They ended up with about 320 acres of land. And, you know, everything was uneventful until one day in the fall, or early fall of 1817, when John Bell was out one day inspecting his cornrows, and he encountered this strange-looking animal. They say it had the head of a rabbit and the body of a dog, kind of like, I guess you would call a hare, something similar to that. And this thing would stare at him, and he couldn't seem to shake it off and just stare at him, but it wouldn't move. He tried to scare it away, you know, no luck there. So finally, he fired a shot. Once he fired the shot, this thing disappeared, as in literally disappeared in thin air.
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, he didn't think a whole lot about it. I mean, he was getting close to 70 years old, and thought maybe his eyes had been playing tricks on him, and he was sure it was probably somebody's stray dog that just happened to be a little on the ugly side. So didn't think much about it. But then later on, you know, just a few weeks later, his son Drury came in and complained or spoke of having seen this huge bird flying overhead, and it was almost as though this thing was circling him. And he pulled out his gun to shoot it, and before he could even get his gun even loaded, the thing flew away. It was like it knew exactly what he was going to do. Then, not long after that, the really big thing that came up, even though nobody in the family believed it at that point in time, mm-hmm. was when the youngest daughter, Betsy, and some of her friends were outside playing in the pear orchard behind the house one afternoon, and they encountered this very frail, feeble-looking old lady just kind of wandering around back in the orchard. And, you know, thinking she was a new settler to the area who had become lost, they started walking her direction so they could talk to her and say hello. But as they neared where she'd been standing, she went behind one of the pear trees, and they never saw her again. It was like she disappeared.
God, I'm glad they're going to talk to her, not shoot her like everything else.
Yeah, so the story was off to quite a start with these three early apparitions, even though the family really didn't tie them together at that point or really think much of them. But then as the weather began to get colder and winter set in, the family began hearing raps on the outside of their log cabin, and these raps soon came inside, and they were hearing the raps on the inside walls of the cabin, as well as what they described as the sounds of rats gnawing at the bedposts, chains being dragged across the floor, even bricks being dropped on top of the roof. It scared them to death. And the father, John Bell, and his older sons would get up in the middle of the night and go, you know, light the candles and look around the house trying to find out who or what was causing this, but they couldn't find anything. And when they would hear all this banging on the walls outside, they would rush outside, you know, they'd get their muzzleloaders and rush outside trying to find and chase off the culprit. You know, they thought it was probably some neighbor, you know, just playing tricks. But they never found anyone. Every time they would go outside, they would come back in empty-handed. And as soon as they'd close the front door behind them to go inside, these banging sounds would start back. And all throughout the winter, this became worse. And over time, it reached the point to where it was more loud or more pronounced in the children's rooms, especially the bedroom occupied by Betsy Bell and her two younger brothers. Seemed that every night these sounds would happen in there, and they would become more intense and more frequent. Soon thereafter, Betsy and a couple of her brothers began complaining of feeling their bed covers being tugged late at night, as though something were trying to pull the covers back. And, of course, you know, they would yell and scream, and the parents would rush in there. They wouldn't find anything, and they would tell the kids, you know, oh, come on, you're just imagining things. Nothing's going to get you and all that. Mm-hmm. But this became way worse over time. And finally, Betsy decided she had had enough, and decided if this thing were to happen again, she would fight back by pulling the bed cover right back out of the hands of whatever this thing was that was doing this.
Nice, Betsy. She's like the little one, too, of the whole family.
Right. She was just barely about 12 years old when this was happening. And not long there after that, she felt her covers being tugged again. So she reached down, grabbed them, and jerked them back up as far as she could. But then immediately, a loud snapping sound was heard all over the house. and Betsy was screaming her head off, and she was just crying profusely. And John Bell lit his candle, went in there, and one of the older brothers lit his candle, went in there to her room, where they found her lying on the floor, crying and with welts all over her face, where something had invisible had slapped her. And the whole time, her younger brothers, even though they were in the same room, they had been across the room and in their beds the whole time. And, you know, the family had no idea who or what was causing all this. And then it gets worse from there. It seemed that the same things started happening to some of Betsy's younger brothers, as well as even a couple of the older ones as well, where bed covers would be pulled, they would be physically assaulted in their beds, but yet a culprit never could be found. Then finally realizing they were dealing with something way beyond their strength and level of comprehension, John Bell decided to silence the family. He told them not to tell anybody about these incidents or discuss them, anything, with anybody outside the family. And that was for pretty good reason. Number one, this happened about 125 years after the Salem witch trials, and this was in the buckle of the Bible Belt. He didn't want people thinking something was going on at his house that could get him in trouble or possibly burned. And the second reason was that he was an elder in the Red River Baptist Church. And the last thing he wanted was for his church congregation, especially his preacher, to know that there was a supernatural entity living in his home. That would most certainly get him thrown out of the church. So the family kept enduring all these things I've talked about. And as time went on, they became more frequent and more violent. And this just happened month after month. And most of the time it happened inside the house, sometimes even out on the farm, as it began to happen during the day as well as during the night.
Just to Betsy, right?
To everybody at that point.
To everybody.
It started out just with Betsy, and she seemed to bear the brunt of the physical disturbances the entire time. But as far as apparitions are concerned, or just minor physical disturbances like having a chair kicked out from under you, something like that, those things were happening to others in the family. But Betsy herself was having not only that happen, but she was being physically attacked, as in beaten up with this thing and slapped around and everything. In fact, at one point, someone described her as like as though she were going into trances right before these events happened. And in another account, it was said that sometimes she would even vomit up pins and needles.
Oh, whoa.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, all of this took its toll on the Bells for a long time. And finally, John Bell decided to break the silence and get some help. So he sought the farmer next door, James Johnson, who was also his best friend. And he told Johnson about it, and he didn't believe it. He said that it was the John Bell's children, and that the whole thing was a hoax, and that because John was getting old, he just wasn't slick enough to catch him.
Oh, good Lord.
But he agreed, nevertheless, to go spend the night in the Bell home, along with his wife. And that same night, and it seemed nothing really happened for a long time. They had their dinner. They talked a while. They had a prayer meeting and sang hymns. They did all the things all the families there in the Red River Settlement did in the early 1800s. Then they went to bed. Still nothing. But then at some point in the wee hours of the morning, something started vibrating at James Johnson's bed. Woke him up, and he sprang out of the bed, and something hit him right in the back. He turned around. He didn't see anything. And he yelled out, you know, "Who are you? What are you? Why are you here?" And when he did that, everything stopped, at least just for that night. And the next morning at breakfast, he explained to the Bell family that he thought they were dealing with a spirit, and a very evil spirit that had either been disturbed or that the bells had evoked in some other way. He suggested to John Bell that they tell the preacher, which was the last thing John Bell wanted to do. So he decided not to do that, but Johnson eventually convinced him to do so anyway. So they went and told Mr. Bell's preacher, and he actually seemed very compassionate, said a prayer, and he vowed to help, and he vowed to keep the matter silent. Well, within about 3 weeks, people were coming from all over Middle Tennessee, strangers, to find out what this disturbance was over at the Bell home. People would come, some would be believers and want to see if this thing would do anything to them or see if they could witness anybody else being victimized by it. And others were skeptics. And the skeptics were the ones who were saying that the Bells did this to make money, that some of the children had learned ventriloquism and were throwing their voices, because at this point the thing had even begun to whisper and speak, and that the children were staging all of these physical attacks or faking them, you know, just to get attention. And these skeptics seemed to be the ones who were getting attacked. The other visitors, the believers, would actually see things happen to others and sometimes would have things happen to them, but they weren't along the lines of physical attacks like the skeptics were getting. So that was one of the two big developments during this period. One was that this thing hated skeptics, and number two, the thing was beginning to whisper and develop a voice.
Yeah, didn't it like start to sing like hymns and stuff like that? And like at first they couldn't really understand what it was saying, and then eventually they could have like conversations with it?
Yeah, at first they couldn't understand the whispers. They said this thing sounded like almost like a feeble old lady, either chanting or wailing and acting as though she had something to tell them, but just couldn't quite get it out. And they couldn't understand it. You know, it was basically speaking or whispering in chants and whimpers at the beginning. Now, years later, this thing had developed such a strong voice that it could yell and scream and sing hymns, which it did a lot. It was very scary. I mean, just imagine being asleep or eating dinner or something, or talking to somebody, your family, and then all of a sudden you hear this loud scream right into your ear calling you an old fool or telling you that it's going to kill you.
Ooh.
You can't find it. I mean, the ultimate disembodied voice.
And yeah.
Quite scary as well. But this voice grew over time, and it seemed that this, not only the voice, but the physical activity, including the violent parts, grew over time as well. And it seemed that this thing fed off of the attention and energy of others. The more people who would come and try to communicate with it or figure out what it was, the stronger it became. It seemed to feed off of that. Yeah, some nasty stuff for sure.
It's like a Kardashian. And,
yeah. And finally, it reached the point to where people could understand it. And people would ask questions, mainly, you know, what are you and why are you here? What are you trying to do? And it seemingly gave a different answer to every person who asked. It would say it was a spirit buried in the woods who had been disturbed. It would say it was a spirit who had lost a tooth in the woods. I'm sorry. It would say it was a spirit who had lost a tooth and it was looking for the tooth. Sometimes it would say it was the ghost of a treasure hunter who had died nearby and had left treasure behind. It claimed to be all kinds of different things. And, of course, the people would hear these claims and immediately go out and try to find out if there was any truth, you know, in hopes of eradicating this entity. But it didn't work. And one of the preachers who came over regularly to try and find out what they could asked this thing if it was related to anybody locally that lived around there. And it responded that it was Kate Batts's old witch and that it was there to kill John Bell, the father, and make him die the slowest, most horrible death possible.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Well,
that's nice to hear.
Yeah, and well, this latest claim, you know, people took it a little more serious than the others because they all knew Kate Batts, who happened to live about a mile and a half away from the Bell Farm. And her husband was an invalid, so she and her children had to run their entire farm themselves. And they didn't have a lot of money. They were kind of what you would call outcasts of that community. Didn't have a lot of money, and Mrs. Batts had a lot of weird sayings. She would, you know, she often tried to use big words to impress people, but she couldn't pronounce those words properly.
Oh, no.
So yeah, people laughed at her quite a bit. They looked down on her and made fun of her. They thought she was crazy. So when this horrible entity who had learned to talk announced that it was Kate Batts, then everybody said, sure, it told the truth, because that lady's crazy as a fruitcake. that's what they thought anyway.
Wait, so it was saying that it was Kate Batts even though Kate Batts was alive and well?
Yeah, Kate Batts was definitely alive, and it said that. And, you know, I presume it was trying to convince people that Kate Batts was alive and well and practicing black magic.
Okay.
But, you know, anyways, the things claimed to be Kate Batts was taken seriously, even though in my own research I found that Kate Batts had nothing to do with any of this. And she wasn't really crazy. She was just different. She had a much different upbringing than a lot of other people, namely because she was raised for a pretty good portion of her early life by the Cherokee Indians, Native American Indians. And she was taught to make potions and all kinds of different mixes as remedies for a lot of different things. So she was always mixing up things, potions, remedies, things like that. And people would think that she was practicing witchcraft. So, you know, people thought all this about her, and not knowing any better, just assumed she was crazy. And oddly enough, this thing began answering to the name Kate. So from that point on in the story, it became known as Kate. So people felt reasonably sure that this thing really was Kate Batts, simply, you know, like I say, because they thought she was crazy. They looked down on her, and she was always mixing and messing with potions and things like that, even though she was using them for perfectly legitimate healing or cooking reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Still, they thought she might have been practicing witchcraft or casting spells or something like that. So the entity's claim of being Kate Batts really worked well, because people actually bought that and called her Kate. You know, they just simply could not understand why anyone anywhere would want to kill John Bell. He was pretty well liked. He got along with most people, and he certainly didn't do anything to anyone that would make them want to have revenge on him, especially to kill him. And the people would ask Kate, not the person, but the entity that they named Kate, you know, why do you want to kill John Bell? What has he done to you? What has he done to anybody? And Kate would never answer directly. She would only say that he was a bad man. Then she would go down a list of the names of everybody else in the community, male and female, but mostly male, and talk about what bad people they are. Then there were a couple of people, and only a couple, that she said were good. One was Lucy Bell, who was the Bell family's mother, John Bell's wife and Betsy and her brother's mother. And the other was a guy named Calvin Johnson, who was the son of John Bell's best friend, who he initially told the story to, James Johnson. And Kate would go on and on talking about what good people they were, but would scorn and frown on everybody else. And as Kate grew stronger with her voice and with her physical antics and attacks and the apparitions happening, she also grew stronger in intelligence. It seemed that Kate knew every scripture of the Bible and could argue with all the preachers and win the arguments, and even knew about people's pasts. and she loved to tell people about their past, especially any flaws in their past. She's the most judgmental entity ever, and especially when it came to skeptics. When skeptics would come to the house and say that the Bells were trying to perpetrating a hoax, or that somebody else, like the family slaves or neighbors, were, Kate would speak up and tell these people about flaws in their past. Like at one point in time, she told one man who showed up with a couple of friends that he need not talk about doing good for people and being good, because 20 years earlier he had stolen a sheepskin from another man and never got caught.
Oh my God. Jeez. That is insane.
Yeah, how would Kate know this? But in another situation, a whole group of men came there trying to make heads or tails out of this crazy case. And they were in the dining room eating with the Bells one night. In fact, it was the last night before they were to leave and go back home, which I think was somewhere up in Maryland or Virginia, somewhere like that, up there East Coast. And Kate announced that one of the men had kidnapped his wife from her parents' house and taken her off and married her when she was very, very young. And then a few years later, he cheated on her. And even supposedly mentioned the name of the woman that he cheated with for all to hear. So Kate used her and her intelligence to really get back at the skeptics. She was also good about showing up, at least in voice, that is, in a couple of the local churches. And that's one key point there a lot of people don't realize, is that after a while, the Bell Witch entity was not confined just to the Bell home or the Bell farm, but also to other properties and homes in the area, and about a 6-square-mile area, but just not as much as the Bell home. But she would, her voice would be heard in churches in the area every Sunday morning, announcing to the congregation the names of everybody who was laying out a church who didn't have a good reason for doing so. Like she would say, well, old Joe Edwards isn't here because he got drunk last night and he's still skunked out.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, God.
A little snitch entity.
Yeah. Or say, well, if you asked old so-and-so's wife, who is at home sick today, where old so-and-so is, she'll tell you he's at church. But he's not here because he took a detour over here to see Mrs. So-and-so because her husband's gone. You know, Kate was almost in some ways hilarious.
Yeah.
Some of those things you do.
It sounds like the token like drunk aunt on Thanksgiving or something. Like
she had a mean streak that was just remarkable. And by 1819, people were still coming from everywhere, but the story got the attention of one of the military leaders that John Bell's older sons had fought under back in the War of 1812. And that was a man by the name of Major General Andrew Jackson, who lived in Nashville, about 50, 55 miles away. So he brought his men up there one afternoon to go up there to the Bell Farm and spend the night, try to make heads or tails out of what all this stuff was that was going on. And as they approached the property line, their wagons stopped. The horses wouldn't move. They kicked at the horses. Andrew Jackson cursed at the horses. They still wouldn't move. Then suddenly they heard this disembodied voice coming from the trees saying, "That's okay, General. You can pass now, but I'll get with you tonight, and you'll hear more from me."
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, Jackson and his men made it on up there to the Bell home and had a very uneventful night, until one of the men who was with him proclaimed to be a witch doctor and stated that this thing was not doing anything and that there was no activity in the house because this thing was afraid of him, because he had a gun with a silver bullet and he would kill it. Hmm. Well, as soon as he said that, he was physically assaulted, according to legend. He was kicked right in the bottom and flew all the way out the door into the front yard. He was kicked so hard.
Oh, my gosh.
Nice.
And the legend says everybody was scared to death except for Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson was laughing about this. And then Kate allegedly spoke up and said, "General, don't laugh about this. This old man was a fraud, and I got rid of him. But you have another fraud in your party, and I'll tell you who that is tomorrow night. Hmm. So stick around. Well, of course, the men that were with Jackson were all like, oh, I think my wife's having a baby. I think we need to go. I need to go. You know, nobody wanted to stick around to find out, you know, to be exposed as the fraud. Well, Jackson had another idea. His idea was for the men to stay put. They were going to spend a whole another day and night there because he wanted to know which one of his men was a fraud. But anyhow, something changed his mind in the middle of the night that night. And he and his men pulled up their tents out of the front yard and quickly got out of there. And by daybreak, were already out of the area. Don't know why. Don't know what happened. Well, after the Andrew Jackson ordeal, John Bell, his health began to, you know, come into question. It seemed that he had trouble swallowing food sometimes. He would complain and say it felt like there was a stick in his mouth or something pushing outward. It was pushing his cheeks outward to make it where he couldn't chew or swallow on occasion. And over time, this grew worse, and Kate would speak up over and over again, just relentlessly, saying, ah, ha, ha, I told you, old Jack Bell. I told you I'm going to kill you, and that's what I'm going to do. Ha, ha, ha. I love to see you suffer. Old Jack Bell was the nickname given for Mr. Bell by Kate. And his health declined over time. He ended up getting a lot of what they call nervous twitches in his face. And eventually, he even reached the point where he would have seizures. Well, meanwhile, by mid-1819, Betsy Bell was a little bit older and had found herself a boyfriend, Joshua Gardner. Kate didn't like it. But then Kate was furious when Betsy and Joshua announced their engagement. And she kept telling Betsy over and over, don't marry Joshua. Well, Betsy wouldn't have any part of that. She decided to stand up to Kate. And she said, Kate, I don't care what you do. I love Joshua and he loves me. And I'm not going to let you spoil our beautiful life that we're going to have together. The year 1820 set in. John Bell became sicker and sicker. And Kate became happier and happier. She told everybody who came by, you know, neighbors, visitors, believers, skeptics, and everybody, that John Bell's afflictions were her doings and that she was not going to rest easy until she saw the mean old man dead. By mid-1820, and actually by the fall of 1820, John Bell reached the point where he could no longer leave the house. Every time he left the house, he would have a seizure. He would lie down on the ground, couldn't get up for a long time. He would be very weak. And then Kate would pull his boots off of him. And they would have to try to put them back on, and then she'd pull them off of him again. Very traumatic time for Mr. Bell and his family, having to watch him go through all this. Then on December 19th of 1820, John Bell went into a coma. And the next morning, he died, and his family was there at his side, and so was Kate, because she spoke up and just laughed and laughed and laughed and said, oh, old Jack Bell is gone. Oh, yeah. Well, John Bell Jr., as he walked around the room up there where John Bell died, he noticed a strange-looking vial of liquid sitting up in the cupboard. Took a look at it, close look at it, and realized it was nothing that the doctor had left for Mr. Bell. So he sprinkled a couple of drops onto the family cat's tongue. And when he did that, the cat, according to legend, jumped up into the air, rolled over 3 times, and was dead by the time it hit the floor.
Oh, no.
Jeez.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And then Kate spoke up and said, well, I gave old Jack Bell a dose of that last night, and that's what fixed him. So John Jr. became angry and just threw the vial into the fireplace. And when he did that, it exploded and shot this, they said, very sinister-looking blue flame up the fireplace. It was a horrible smell, too. And they never did figure out what was in that vial or whether Kate really put poison liquid in that vial, or perhaps someone else did for some reason.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
John Bell's funeral was one of the largest funerals ever held in Robertson County, even to this day. And Kate sang the entire time that they were pouring dirt into his grave, and until the very last mourner left the graveyard. According to legend, the song she sang was the song that goes like, "Romeo, Romeo, oh, row me up a bottle of brandy-o." And she sang this song about a bottle of brandy in a very drunken voice. As if she had been drinking and celebrating and, you know, was just about to pass out herself. She was so happy and celebrating. Well, interestingly enough, after John Bell's passing, all the disturbances seemed to die down, almost to the point that they weren't even happening. Everything just got very, very quiet. And this lasted actually until Easter Monday in April of 1821, when the community had a picnic down at the Red River, and Joshua Gardner and Betsy Bell had their own little private picnic and fishing trip at the river and began to discuss more about their marriage plans. When they did that, Kate showed up again and screamed into Betsy's ears over and over and over again, "Don't marry Joshua Gardner." Well, at that point, she reconsidered and decided that Joshua may very well suffer the same fate that her father had suffered if they were to go through the marriage. So she broke up with him. And legend has it they never saw each other again, even though they really did. But that's another story for another time. Interesting story, too. But at any rate, Joshua Gardner moved to West Tennessee shortly thereafter and lived there the rest of his life. Lived a very great, wonderful life and lived to be a very old man. After the breakup between Joshua and Betsy, Kate pretty much disappeared. And by June of that year, there was nothing going on. And one day, Kate spoke up and said she will be back in 7 years. And sure enough, Kate left, and nobody in the area heard of Kate for 7 years. It was as though nothing happened. It was like Kate did not exist. But then 7 years later, in 1828, Kate appeared to John Bell Jr., and they had a series of conferences about the past, the present, the future, and civilizations over a period of about 3 nights. Then she bade farewell again, this time promising to return in 107 years, which would have been 1935. Whether Kate showed up in 1935 or not, we don't know. We hear different things. I asked my mother one time before her own death, and because she was alive and well in 1935, she said they had so much to worry about with the Great Depression and other things that they didn't have time to think about a bunch of old spooks, as she called them. Yeah. But a lot of people say Kate never left the Bell Farm to begin with, because people are always experiencing strange things there even today. Of course, not along the lines of the physical attacks and open apparitions that the Bells experienced almost 200 years ago. But there's definitely something there, and it's been there for a very long time. And that is my very short version of the Bell Witch.
I got a few questions. They might not be in order, Pat. But one is, what stands there today?
The original Bell home was razed in about 1853. And that has been proven by an old letter between two of the Bell sons, one of who had been away for a long time at that time, as well as some writings from other people. And later, there was a cabin that was put on to, a picture of the cabin was put onto postcards, and I think 1909, and again later, and now it's all over the internet, and people say that this was the John Bell home or the Bellwitch home.
Okay.
Looks like an old white siding home that hadn't been lived in a while. Mm-hmm. That is not John Bell's home. That was the home of John Bell Jr. Very, very, very much later than the home of John Bell.
Mm-hmm.
So what stands now on the Bell Farm. First of all, we have to realize that it has been subdivided out to a lot of different people. There are houses on the original Bell Farm. There are businesses, a museum, an old schoolhouse, a public graveyard, a lot of things. But as for Ground Zero, which I'll call the 100 acres where the house, the well, and the Bell family graveyard stood, Ground Zero, that has remained in the Bell family and still is today. It is actually owned by a trust, and most of the people, I believe, are members of the Bell family. And it was created years ago by a Bell family descendant who was a lawyer. And that trust owns the Ground Zero property today. It is used for tobacco farming.
Okay.
But there's not a house there. There's no house on that Ground Zero tract.
Now, I was watching a few of your videos also, and you had mentioned something about how one of the sons, I believe it was, had moved to Mississippi, and you believe that Kate had followed him, or...
That is where the Mississippi version of the Bell Witch comes from.
Okay.
There are three different versions, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Mississippi. And we do know historically that the Bell children, three of them, actually moved there. There was Esther Bell, who was the oldest daughter, and her husband, Alex Porter. They moved around 1836. Then the oldest son, Jesse Bell, and his wife, Martha. Then around 1839, Jesse Bell, the oldest son, and his wife, Martha, moved to Mississippi. Years later, Betsy Bell, her health began to decline, and she moved to Mississippi so that her daughter could take care of her. So there were three Bell children in all who moved to Mississippi.
Okay.
And as you know, a little after they moved there, at some point after those Bell children moved to Mississippi, the Mississippi version of the Bell Witch started. And the video you saw was probably my short take on the Mississippi version and what that involved.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, they settled down there in Mississippi around the present-day town of Batesville. And Betsy settled near the present-day town of Water Valley, which was like 30 or 40 miles away from Batesville.
Interesting.
And then there was stuff in North Carolina, too, that kept happening to the other ones? Or
well, the North Carolina legend affected John and Lucy Bell and their family before they moved to Tennessee. Now, granted, their family was much smaller then because they gave birth to more children after they moved to Tennessee.
Right.
But the North Carolina version, to make a very long story short, centers on John Bell's not being able to get along with the slave overseer for his farm. And when the slave overseer was heard making some rather spicy comments about John Bell's daughter, Mary, John Bell ended up shooting him. That was his ultimate reason for shooting him. I guess he was waiting to get the guy in some way, and then that he'd had enough. And according to that legend, although not fact, according to legend, he shot the overseer, whose name was John Black. And in the 2 to 3 years after that, the family experienced a lot of bad luck, mainly in the form of crop failure, which means they could not make very much money. It hit their bottom line really hard. And that theory of the legend states that that's why they ultimately moved to Tennessee, to start a new life with people, that some of whom they had already known from North Carolina, and in an area that was very fertile and looked very promising from an agricultural standpoint.
Okay, and then some theorize that maybe he was the one who put the curse, because there's the main theories I was reading about was it was Kate Batts, which didn't make sense, but you explained, you know, that people thought she created something, and, you know, that's what the more popular version of the legend is. Another theory was that it was John Black, that he put the curse on them, and all the stuff that happened was a result of his curse.
Okay, well, what we have to look at with the allegation of Kate Batts and the placement of a curse, as well as John Black and the allegation of his placing a curse, those are sub-theories. There are about, I've never counted, but I would say there has to be at least over 100 completely different theories as to the Bell Witch.
Oh my gosh.
And we will not be going over all of them.
Yeah,
tonight.
We'll have to go about five.
No, you'll have to wait. You'll have to wait for my next book or video for that. No, I was just kidding. But a lot of people believe a lot of different things, and I collect all that information and all of those beliefs and analyze those, see what I can find, and investigate those.
Mm-hmm.
Out of probably 100 different theories or proposed theories about the Bell Witch, a curse is only one theory.
Oh.
You know, it's just one theory out of 100. Now, the curse theory is a theory, and it has three sub-theories. One sub-theory is that a curse was placed by John Black. Second sub-theory is that there was a curse placed by Kate Batts. The third sub-theory is that there was a curse placed by a Native American spirit. So the curse theory is only one of many theories. It is one that I don't think any TV show has ever explored up until the A&E series recently called Cursed, which actually explored that one theory, the curse theory, and went down the line, you know, looking at possibility of John Black or Kate Batts or even family members, for that matter, or Native Americans doing a curse. So, yeah, the curse is just one theory. And John Black, it is said with the curse theory that he placed the curse as he lay on the ground dying. He was allegedly shot in the stomach. And, of course, that's a heck of a way to go, because you're not going to die instantly. You're going to lay there and bleed and suffer and hurt for a long time before you finally go out.
Yeah.
So as he lay dying, he allegedly placed this curse. Excuse me. One theory that parallels the Kate Batts curse theory is the theory that she was alive and well and practicing black magic, and that it was not a curse but a spell. Then the Kate Batts curse theory is that on her deathbed, she placed a curse on the Bell family. But we know through very simple research, or anybody long enough to sit down and read the book or listen to me, Kate Batts outlived John Bell by 23 years. So there's no way she could have cursed him from the dead.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's the one part that was so confusing. Maybe from what?
Maybe it could have happened the other way around. Perhaps John Bell placed a curse on her, but I don't know why, because they never, ever had any type of dispute or falling out.
Yeah. I was reading things like there was like a couple of theories of disputes, like maybe over land, or then like the always popular, like, oh, they had a thing on the side and he, you know, got her pregnant and, you know, like all those type of reasons.
Well, as the Germans would say, that's a bunch of Butchkin Shushkin. Yeah, it's the biggest bunch of BS you ever heard in your life. There are some popular theories that came from oral tellings of the story, but are really popular on the internet, which is important because, you know as well as I do, if it's on the internet, it's got to be true.
Of course.
Yeah, he's a French model.
But these theories, or so-called theories that you hear about on the internet so much, that John Bell cheated Kate Batts out of a land deal or something of that effect, or they had some kind of falling out. That's not the case at all. But I'll tell you how that happened, how all that came about, because I found it in my research.
Oh, great.
It's right out. It's out there on the public records and the church records. You can find it. Anybody can find it, you know, if they just look, but a lot of people don't. What happened was, shortly before the disturbances began, John Bell had a property line dispute with a man named Josiah Fort. That matter was resolved by the church, as most matters were, and Josiah Fort ended up leaving Red River Church and going to church somewhere else. Interestingly, years later, after John Bell died, Josiah Fort returned to Red River Church. The other dispute was between John Bell and Benjamin Batts, who was the brother-in-law of Kate Batts, over the sale of a slave. John Bell, Mr. Batts felt, charged too much interest. So he filed charges against Mr. Bell and the church, and the church found Mr. Bell not guilty. Well, Mr. Batts was furious, so he went and filed charges in a court of law, and they did find Mr. Bell guilty of usury or charging too much interest.
Oh.
So then the church said, okay, John Bell is one of our elders. We know he was not guilty, but since he was found guilty in court, it embarrasses this church. And then they kicked him out of church, John Bell out of church for that. So you take the Josiah Fort property dispute, you take the Benjamin Batts slave dispute, put those in a kettle, mix them up, let them simmer for almost 200 years, and what do you get? You get John Bell, Kate Batts, property dispute.
Ah.
That's where that came from, but it's like I say, it's a bunch of buchenscheichen.
Right.
I don't know what your language policy is, so, but it's definitely a lot of BS, and it seems the more that we serious researchers put out the actual records out there and show people and try to teach people better, the more people come up with this thing of John Bell and Kate Batts, this, that, and the other. But it's crazy.
Yeah. And a woman doing business, that's crazy. So what about the other theory? So then there's the abuse theory, if you want to talk about that at all, you know, saying that basically maybe Betsy was being abused by her dad and she created a poltergeist. And that's what that movie, An American Haunting, was based on.
Yeah, the abuse theory, that is where somebody said maybe John Bell physically abused his daughter, and as a result, her mind or her subconscious mind evoked a poltergeist that attacked him and killed him to punish him, and attacked herself to punish her for not telling anybody about it. One was an element of her anger, one target was an element of her guilt. And where that comes from is a theory from back in the 1930s and 40s by Dr. Nándor Fodor, who was a Hungarian lawyer turned parapsychologist who did a lot of research into poltergeist cases and concluded that in most poltergeist cases, an adolescent, usually traumatized, was around at the times the poltergeist would attack. Then later in the 1960s, William Rohl from the University of North Carolina did some more study and concluded that this phenomenon was happening, you know, randomly, and that the person whose mind evoked the poltergeist, the agent, as it's called, was not even aware that it was his or her mind creating the poltergeist. And it just happened randomly and all the time. So the term came about called RSPK, or recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, mind over matter. So that theory, you could plug a lot of things into it. And the first person who tried to plug the Bell Witch into that theory was a feature article writer for Playboy magazine.
That's awesome.
And you know, Playboy, especially back in those days, had to, you know, take whatever stories they had into the bedroom as much as they could.
Mm.
So in their November 1968 article about the Bell Witch, they plugged that into the theory, or into the story, to make it sound as though Betsy Bell was being abused, and that's what evoked the poltergeist. Then years later, one author used the same thing in their book. Then another author used the same theory in their book. Then another author even copied that and used the same theory in their book. And then one of those books had a movie made about it called An American Haunting. So we've got this whole abuse theory being thrown out here constantly. And, you know, my take on it, first of all, to say that the Bell Witch was a poltergeist is a mistake. Although the Bell Witch exhibited poltergeist characteristics for a little while, very early on, the Bell Witch entity also was a ghost because it was an apparition, was also a demon because it divided into ranks and had such great biblical knowledge and attacked people and possessed people, and was also a spirit of a high magnitude because it possessed so much intelligence. So nobody can say the Bell Witch was strictly a poltergeist. It was a lot of different things at a lot of different times.
Yeah.
So on the abuse theory, not only are we using a poltergeist theory to describe a non-poltergeist entity, but an electric entity, but more importantly, we have zero proof. And of course, you know, people's frames of reference and standards of proof vary greatly.
As we know in this field.
Some people will believe anything, and then others, like me, will believe nothing unless they have absolute, cold, hard, concrete proof of it. So with the abuse theory, all we have is an accusation, but we don't have anything. We don't have a video showing it happening. We don't have John Bell or Betsy Bell signing an affidavit under legal oath saying that they participated in such an act, you know, and that's all we can have nowadays.
Right.
Because we don't, right, we, even if they signed an affidavit, that doesn't make it true because people lie all the time. So, you know, really, there's no way to know whether it really happened for sure unless you actually saw it happen. And nobody has. So that's why I say, you know, with the abuse theory, you can't really say, yes, it did happen, or no, it definitely did not happen. All you can say is that, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty, and there is no proof.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, it's something you still hear today that teens or, I mean, even adults, but, you know, suffer trauma, and that's, you know, why they create a poltergeist and everything.
Right.
Yeah. It's good, but it doesn't account for, like you said, haunting things in a 6-mile radius and, you know, coming back year after year, like in 1935, it was going to come back, right?
Yeah. Did that ever happen?
I don't know. Some people say it never left the place because of so many things, you know, so many things that have happened there. Mm. Over the years, and definitely, you know, more things than just, you know, objects moving or anything like that, but anomalous photos and videos, a lot of different EVPs, even some mist-like apparitions that people have been able to capture on camera there in the area. So a whole lot going on. And that happened even before 1935. Probably not the EVP part, but, you know, people feeling a presence there, hearing their name whispered, or putting something down like on a table somewhere only to find it on the floor or perhaps out in the field a little later on. Mm. You know, strange things.
Are there a lot of John Bell's family still around?
Yeah, there's a lot of descendants of the John Bell family. Mm-hmm. They're scattered out all over everywhere. I know east of the Mississippi there are a lot, and there are also some in Arkansas and quite a few over in Texas as well.
Nice.
And then you do tours now, so you were just saying, like, today there's a lot of evidence. That's the other big thing you do. So when you're not, you know, holed up in your office writing these things, you actually go out and do lectures and overnight investigations and all that?
Right. Like my page says, I'm an author and paranormal adventurer, which means anytime I'm not writing, I'm either out exploring something having to do with the paranormal or actually conducting an investigation. And, you know, I've never counted. I know I do more than 30 different investigations each year. And quite a few of them are right here because they're convenient. And some of these places around here are extremely haunted. But then I also do a lot of traveling as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you do it at the Bell Witch structures that are still standing? Like the Bell Witch Cave. I see that. I've heard of that a lot. I saw it on YouTube.
On the Bell property, it's very, very hard to get any type of permission to do an investigation. I've brought equipment to places where you can that are in the area, such as public places there in the area, you know, like the flashlights, EMF meters, things like that. and, you know, just use them on different occasions. And I've had some results, and I've had friends who've had some results too. An occasional EVP, quite a bit of flashlight responses, quite a bit of EMF. Sometimes even in areas of these public places where there's no, you know, no electricity nearby, and when people have had their cell phones off. So definitely a lot of activity going on up there.
Cool. So I like that. So you research it and you're also skeptical, which is good. So, I mean, studying for all this time, do you think this definitely happened, or is there any part of you that, you know, goes with some of the other theories? Like some people say, like, well, the first book wasn't written until, you know, some guy, Ingram, wrote the first book on the Bell Witch, and that came from like an alleged diary of one of the sons that may or may not have existed and all that.
Yeah, but like I said, there are a whole lot of theories out there, both natural theories, paranormal theories, and there's also, you know, a lot of skeptical theories. As for the Ingram book theory, everybody already knows that Ingram wrote the first book on the subject. And most everybody knows that the diary that it is based upon, or allegedly based upon, has not been found.
Can you just give a quick little background on that, just for people listening that, like, are maybe hearing this for the first time or don't know that theory?
Oh, I can tell you a little bit about it. I can't say too much about the Ingram book because that is a competitor.
Okay.
I'll just mention that it exists, but that's about it. Mm-hmm. The book that was written in 1894 by Ingram was based largely on a diary supposedly written by one of the Bell sons, Richard Williams Bell, in 1846. Well, the diary, or so-called diary, nobody's come forward with it. Now, granted, I get emails every week from people claiming to have it.
No way.
Yeah, constantly. But then when I ask them to produce it, I never hear from them again, or they write an email back telling me I'm a meanie or something like that. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, unless I could put my fingers on it or put my eyes right in front of it at least and send it off to an independent university testing lab and have the handwriting analyzed and the pages dated, I'm going to continue to say it doesn't exist. And that just goes back to my standard of proof.
Right.
And nobody's been able to come forward with it. So where that leads us is that some people feel that perhaps Ingram could have made this thing up, because the whole thing up, because after all, he stated that he couldn't write the book until after all of John Bell's children had died.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he knew several of their relatives, and they apparently didn't have a problem with it, at least the ones here in Tennessee didn't. You know, that's the theory, that maybe he made the whole thing up. That and, the diary's not there, and the fact that he was a newspaper publisher, and he was a writer anyway. So, you know, maybe he just used his imagination and made it up, perhaps to cover something up.
Right. They're saying, and like 1800 to 1821 and further just maybe never happened. And just one day in, what was it, 1894, this guy just writes a book called The Haunting, and we take it from there.
And refers to it that it happened long ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what it is. And that, you know, the skeptical theory is there. He made this whole thing up, and that. You know, there may very well have been a John Bell family. We can prove that. But the part about them being visited and tormented by a paranormal entity, we can't. So, and that's what Ingram supposedly made up. And the whole bottom line on that whole theory there is, based on where and when Ingram grew up, and his age and things going on in his life during the time the book was written and all that, and all the people he had a chance to meet and talk to, he very well could have made it up. But there's two things in the way of that. One is, we don't have any proof that he made it up. We just have a bunch of people throwing a bunch of circumstantial evidence out there. You know, maybe he did this, maybe he did that, or it seems logically did that. Well, you know, it's one of those things, whoop-de-doo. Well, but did he or did he not? And nobody seems to be able to answer that. So that's one part of this theory of the Ingram making it up. The other thing is that the Johnson family, who I spoke of when I was telling the story.
Oh, yeah, the best friend slash neighbor that slept over.
Right, right, James Johnson. And he and his sons experienced this thing a lot. There are stories and information that was passed down from his family line from those days. This is not in the form of Richard Bell's diary. This is a whole separate set of stories handed down through an entirely separate family from the very beginning. So, yes, this thing was known about long before Ingram wrote the book. And just recently, someone in Kentucky has come forward and stated, or actually shown somebody, a letter that he had found. It had been passed, I think it was part of some family documents or something that was found, an old letter where somebody was talking about the Bell Witch in a letter. And this letter is dated well before 1894, when Ingram allegedly made all this up. So there is definitely some evidence of the Bell Witch having been talked about and discussed long before Ingram entered the scene in 1894.
Interesting. And it seems like if he ran a newspaper, you know, that's fact, not fiction. So it would kind of almost make more sense that he came out with the book because he was researching articles just like any other article he would do. He's interested in fact and writing about it and all of that.
Well, yeah, you would think so. Now, not with today's newspapers. No. I don't trust today's media at all. It's
I'm with you there.
There's not the concept of responsible journalism went out the window several years ago, but back then I would consider the newspaper dealing strictly with fact. But you know, at the same time, Ingram didn't write this book under the auspices of the newspaper, even though the Leaf Chronicle was who actually published it. He didn't write it as Martin Ingram, the newspaper reporter or newspaper editor. He just wrote it as M.V. Ingram and left it at that. And there was a lot of interest back then in the paranormal in that Victorian era, interest in ghost stories and seances and that sort of thing. A lot of people were into that. And, you know, Ingram, being that he was a writer, he was probably a reader as well. And I would say he got interested in those things as well. You know, but again, there's no proof that he came out and did his own project and made the whole thing up. But there is evidence and proof that has come down the lines of other family and through other people, aside from the Bells, about the Bell Witch that predated Ingram's account.
Oh, interesting.
How do the family of the Bells now feel about talking about the whole story?
Well, in my opinion, based on all the meetings and discussions I've had with Bell descendants, they're divided three ways. One third are believers and like to talk about it. One third are indifferent and have no interest in talking about it. And the other third are very staunch non-believers. Mm-hmm. And if they talk about it, it will usually be to express their dislike for the legend and especially their dislike for people who write books about the legend. So there is no consensus of opinion among the Bell descendants. Different ones feel different ways.
The ones that do talk about it, you know, that A&E series that was released last October, Curse the Bell Witch. How did you like how that came out? You were featured on it. That was cool. I saw they turned to you a few different times in their search, going through all these theories.
Well, you know, the only thing I can really speak about on Cursed are the parts that I was actually in or was present for the filming. You know, I was in all five episodes in one way or another, but I was only there for a few of the actual filmings. So as far as what, you know, went on behind the scenes or how this story piece evolved or that, you know, I really don't know unless I was there. I think the show took a good unprecedented look at the curse theory, which again is just one of many theories. And I think they did a you know, they did a fairly thorough job of doing that. And I know they did a lot of homework ahead of time. I do think, or I hope, the show can get a second season, you know, just to explore the curse theory, because there's a whole lot more to the curse theory in terms of not only clarification of some things that came up in episode 4, but also in terms of possibilities with regard to people and motive. You know, so there's, you know, I think A&E's Cursed this year, season 1 was a good primer or introduction to the Bell Witch curse theory. But we've got a lot of ground to cover, and I hope they'll go ahead and ground a second season so we can start down that path.
Oh, that'd be interesting.
Yeah, that would be fun.
I could see how they maybe would do it. I didn't know about it at the time, but you know, preparing for, you know, talking to you, we found it on YouTube, and I thought it was like pretty well done. I like that how they just went theory by theory. So I think the A&E Curse series was pretty well done, the 5 episodes. For anyone who hasn't seen it, what they did was one of the Bell descendants,
John Selak.
Yeah, so the series, they take him and they go over all the theories. They go into the town. Like you said, it's really like the curse theory that they're doing, but they're looking at it as cops. So it was cool. They had like, you know, a board up like evidence, suspects, motive. Like, I thought that was pretty cool how they did it and went over the history.
And I'm glad you realized what it was, because a lot of people didn't realize it. When they saw the show, they didn't catch the part where John and Chad specifically discussed their approach and said that they were going to discuss it as police officers and approach it as a homicide investigation.
Yes.
So, you know, the show came on and some people were like, this is not how you do a paranormal investigation. And I'm thinking, gee, I wish I could say something, but A&E would spank me, or I would tell these people, listen, darn it, this is a homicide investigation, not a paranormal investigation. Even though paranormal investigative techniques were used throughout the show, and a lot of the scenes were reminiscent of what you'd see in a paranormal investigation. But yeah, I thought it was a good attempt at explaining the curse theory, but I think there's just a whole lot more ground that needs to be covered in that, whether it's through a season 2 on A&E or whether one of us just picks up the video camera and does our own low budget thing. But I do think the curse theory needs more explanation.
Yeah. And doing the half and half, like looking at it that way. And yeah, they did the ghost hunting part 2, which I think is probably what people more tuned into. Everyone, you know, still loves that. So they might have spaced out during the interview parts and just watching the ghost hunting part. And I mean, and that was done just like any other show, though, you know, things off to the side. One thing that was driving me crazy, though, and I know it drives other people crazy. They had brought that dog, Newton. And the dog was always barking, and they're going, oh, Newton sees something. Newton wants to go over there. Oh, calm down, Newton. Sit, Newton. And I'm like, no, don't bring the dog if you're not going to use the dog. Like, stick the dog on whatever it's seeing. Like, that's how I want you to investigate. But other than that.
Yeah, that was the coolest dog. He's specially trained, and he can, you know, he could pick up on just about anything and obeys commands and everything. We had a lot of fun with him.
Yeah, I just wish they'd let him go. Instead of like, he sees something. Okay, don't do anything. No, that was a beautiful dog, though. So, yeah, maybe there'll be a season 2. That would be cool. And what about for you? Any things you want to plug? New books coming out? I mean, you have your, you know, main 3 books out. The
any
two
lectures, appearances anywhere?
Okay, got quite a bit going on. Several books in progress. I guess to make a long story short, the best way, if anybody's interested in finding out, you know, what I'm doing or want to catch up on any of that, is to go to the website www.patfitzhugh.com, or there is a Facebook page out there. Just look up my name. Also, there is a Facebook page about the Bell Witch book. You just type in Bell Witch full account into Facebook and you can find that page. About the website I mentioned, patfitchhugh.com, there is a tab up there at the top called Appearances, and that is a list of lecture appearances, book signings, that sort of thing.
Right. What are the two differences? I just want to ask one last thing. With the books, your Bellwitch and then Bellwitch Full Account, since people, I'm sure, are going to Google them now and wonder which one to get. What's the difference between the two?
Okay. The Bellwitch Haunting was a book I wrote back in the 1990s as a bridge book because the Bellwitch The Full Account first edition was supposed to come out, but I had some more information I had to verify, yet people were still wanting a Bellwitch book. So I did The Bellwitch Haunting in its place just to kind of tide everybody over. The Bellwitch Haunting book is out of print right now. It already served its purpose. And then but it was a very small book, just an overview, about 120 pages, 130 pages, I believe. And, you know, just high level overview of the Bellwitch legend. The Bellwitch, The Full Account, on the other hand, which I update every couple years to keep current, is 406 pages.
Oh, my.
It covers from North Carolina to Mississippi and from the early 1800s until present day, which is why I call it The Full Account.
Oh, yeah.
Covers the full time frame and full geographic range. And that book, it contains, of course, the original story, plus a lot of information about theories, the family, the people involved, things going on at the time, a section about popular Bellwitch myths. And the information in there is documented in the form of footnotes and endnotes, where anybody reading the book who wants to go out and find this information on their own will know exactly where to find it. So that's the difference between those two. And there's another book out there called Ghostly Cries from Dixie, the American South. And there's a sequel to that called More Ghostly Cries from Dixie, More Ghostly Cries from Dixie, that will be coming out pretty soon.
Oh, very cool.
Sounds awesome.
Ooh, all right. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Pat. We really appreciate it.
Pat, you're an amazing interview, and we love reading what you're doing and seeing more videos, so we look forward to more.
Yeah, and hopefully maybe we can talk to you again sometime if you're interested on all these other legends you cover.
Thank you again. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for joining us tonight.
Yeah, it's been great. It's been a lot of fun. Great conversation and everything. We need to do this again sometime.
Yeah.
And, you know, feel free to hook up with one of my Facebook pages or just send me a friend request. And as long as I know who you are, I'll answer it.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Pat.
Okay. Well, we'll talk to you later. And you guys have a great night. And thanks again.
You as well.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for listening to another episode of Dead Tribe Paranormal.
Thanks for listening to Dead Tribe Paranormal. After you're done, please listen to our other podcast, Rock Stories. In this series, we meet with music artists and bands that are out there keeping the scene alive. We capture and share their stories with you, the fans, and use their music as a soundtrack. Also look forward to new shows like Audibly Anonymous, the show where you, the listener, can anonymously share your deepest secrets. Please visit our website at echopodmedia.com and sign up for our email list on the homepage.
Hi, I'm Karen of Readings by Karen. Do you wonder where your life is headed? About work, family, relationships? Now is the time to contact a professional intuitive. I can give you the clarity you deserve to make the tough decisions in your life. Lower your anxieties and call today, 860-665-8024, or visit me on the web at readingsbykaren.com. Call today, 860-665-8024, or readingsbykaren.com. Readings by Karen, what's in your future?
Hello, world. You're listening to Echo Pod Media.